nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction and indeed for your invitation. It's a treat to be here, and I'm always encouraged when I see busy, smart people turning out in the evening to do something they haven't really got to do. Particularly when the word ethics is in the title, which is pretty much the biggest turnoff you can get if you're trying to promote an event. So it's a privilege to be here. I'm delighted that you've taken time to arrange and join this meeting. As you adjust, I'm from Chicago, as you can tell. As you adjust to my Chicago accent, I will tell you a story. We moved here from the UK almost 20 years ago now. One evening, I was out doing some shopping at the local supermarket. And the young woman at the checkout was being very friendly and chatting to me. And she said, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Edinburgh in Scotland. I'm British." And she said, "How long have you been here?" And I said, "Oh, less than 2 weeks." She said, "Your English is very good." At least you got the joke, yes. My English is not as good as it was, but those of you who are native-born Americans can't tell. I have, despite myself, adapted somewhat. What I'd like to do this evening is to raise some basic questions at the interface of technology and ethics and policy. And to do so, if you like, using the nanotechnology question as a theme, as something of an illustration, and something of an example of, if you like, the problematics of developing policy and having ethical discussions around technology in general. Because, and this, if you like, is in one line, is my primary concern, that we are ill-prepared for the implications, broad social, cultural, policy implications of emerging technologies, ill-prepared even to have the right kind of discussion or an appropriate discussion about their broader significance and their extraordinary, transformative, final significance within our culture, and that we need to find fresh and far more effective ways of engaging these questions. That's true of whatever technology you want to put in the blank. The phrase converging technologies, or the, I think, somewhat happier phrase emerging technologies, have been used for various purposes. And they both make the point that you can put what technology you like into the equation, you get the same answer. It's the same problem, not least as, of course, technologies are beginning to affect each other increasingly, and this builds into the final unpredictability of what kind of social impact they will have. So that, by way of the broadest introduction, my own background, as has been said, I've been working in bioethics now for, 25 years and more. I've been increasingly interested in the technology-policy interface and in developing the Center on Nanotechnology and Society at IIT in Chicago. We've focused particularly on bringing together various parties to the table. And I have a lot of confidence in the capacity of people when they come round the table to have a common conversation. And so we brought together people, obviously, from regulatory and legal contexts, from ethical, civil society, NGO contexts, and, of course, from the business and finance communities to have conversations about the implications of, in this case, nanotechnology, particularly with a view to feeding that conversation in to the policy discussions, insofar as there are policy discussions taking place. And we've done that in our project, both in Chicago, where we have a thing called the Chicago Nano Forum, which is a sort of after-hours seminar every few months, which brings people together from these various communities. And it's interesting who turns up at these events. We have people from different, number of the consulates in Chicago have been quite involved with this. We have people obviously from the nano business community, people from the arts. Once you begin to have an interdisciplinary conversation and invite parties around the table, I think there is a capacity to begin to find a new shape for the conversation. We've also had so far two of our annual conferences in Washington, D.C., focused on nanotechnology policy. Most recent one was just before the end of the year, and we had there people from the House Science Committee, which, as you may know, is involved in the reauthorization of the 2003 Nanotechnology Act, and from the AFL-CIO, and from environmental organizations, and from major business organizations, as well as the sort of policy pundit people, in a common conversation. And that seems to me to be something of the groundwork we need to lay for our discussion of essentially human values and the values we use to frame the policy which we embrace for the development and application of emerging technologies. So that by way of a general perspective on the kind of thing that I think we need to do. What I want to do this evening is first talk a bit about the development or the non-development of policy on nanotechnology here in the United States, and make some broader comments about the significance of some rather strange things which have happened in the course of the last few years, I think largely through inattention rather than something more malign. And then move on to some particular comments about the ethical challenges which I believe are raised by nanotechnology in particular. And then perhaps draw some conclusions about the way in which I think we should be seeking to frame the conversation. So that is the outline. And then we'll have some time for questions and for discussion. I'm assuming that all of you have some interest in the nanotechnology policy discussion. I know some of you are working as researchers in nano-related areas. But for those who don't know, the emergence of nanotechnology as a policy focus in the United States derives from a speech which President Clinton gave at Caltech back in 2000, in which he launched the National Nanotechnology Initiative. It wasn't a funded program, it was simply a framing of questions, which brought together initially a number of agencies and now a couple of dozen agencies. The 2003 Act, the 21st Century Nanotechnology R&D Act, to give it its title, and you can see the sort of effort to excite people about the 21st century, which was somewhat exciting still back in 2003 when the Act was passed and signed by President Bush. And 21st century sounds a little bit sort of passé now as a way of exciting people. But the attempt was to excite people, and indeed Congress got excited. And around $1 billion, federal dollars a year, has been spent on the initiative. It isn't an initiative, it isn't a project, which has, I think, caused some problems. For those who know how the federal government works, there is an interagency working group. There are now some two dozen agencies involved. There's obviously a major defense involvement, as there tends to be in all these technology areas. National Science Foundation is the largest participant in dollar terms. But if you go into this, you will find funding and projects spread right across much of the federal government, because, of course, nanotechnology relates to so many different areas of federal research, federally funded research. It is the case that the policy has been pulled together and essentially framed. The project has been by the Office of Science and Technology Policy and the OSTP, which is the administration's central policy office across the whole S&T area, has taken some initiatives of its own. And in fact, a year ago, just over a year ago, OSTP organized a first workshop on the ethical implications of nanotechnology or the ethical issues raised by nanotechnology. There was some discussion about the terms to be used for this workshop at Arizona State, in which one or two of us were involved. Although we have yet to see a report from this workshop, which is now, I think, 13 or 14 months ago. But it was an attempt to begin to frame, in the context of a federally initiated discussion, the kind of ethical questions which would be raised by the emergence of the technology. Currently, the Act is in the process of the reauthorization process going through Congress, and its outcome is not yet entirely, is not yet clear, but there has been an effort to see what has been happening, and there are various reporting mechanisms. A lot of reports have been generated in the course of the last few years. The National Academies have been involved, as well as OSTP itself, and a lot of reporting activity, as well as a lot of research funding, is now being reviewed in Congress. And we shall see what results. The single most controversial issue being raised during this entire process has been the question of federally funded research into environmental implications of nanotechnology. Not applications, although there has been money going into applications. And many of the most exciting things, of course, happening in the nano field are precisely in the area of the application to environmental questions. But the implications, particularly in the area of toxicology, and there's a huge issue here, and some of you will be expert in it, but there has been considerable controversy over the low level of federal funding through the initiative for studies in toxicology. I think it was maybe 3 years ago, the EPA announced they were spending $5 million on nanotox research, and a journalist asked the spokesman for the EPA, a spokeswoman, is this enough? This isn't very much. And her candid, unusually candid comment back to the journalist was, but it's infinitely more than we've spent so far, which was a perhaps a somewhat undiplomatic way of being diplomatic. That level of funding has gone up. Although, again, some of you may know that there has been a somewhat unusual coming together of environmentalists and those in the business community on this very particular question. And there was a somewhat notorious op-ed in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago from the head of one of the major chemical companies and the head of one of the major environmental organizations, coming together to ask for an increase to $100 million for this particular area. And it's been a very interesting theme. And in fact, the conference which we arranged back in before the end of last year interested me that we had the AFL-CIO and the American Chemical Council saying some very similar things. And of course, what that relates to is less, perhaps, a concern that we avoid nanotechnology causing problems by poisoning people, and more a concern about where you place the responsibility for handling the risk involved, how you allocate the risk involved in research, development, manufacturing. And there certainly is a strong sense that there should be more public participation in risk, and less of it should be left to the private sector. But there's a whole series of discussions of that kind, but that has been the question which has raised the most fundamental issues. And at one level, of course, it isn't an ethical issue per se. That is to say, it is an ethical issue whether we are killed by something which is toxic. But the focus here essentially is a prudential focus. It's a question of where you do allocate the risk, you know, how much is enough. One of the points being made by those who speak on behalf of the decisions which have been taken by the administration tends to be, well, you can spend basically indefinite amounts of money in toxicology efforts. And where do you stop? Because essentially, of course, what you're doing is creating sort of what are, from some points of view, new materials at all sorts of scales. And if you treat them as new materials and treat them as if they were fresh chemicals, then you would be involved in vast expenditures. And that a better approach is to balance some work of this kind and some after the event reporting. And they've been developing voluntary reporting schemes. There's been a whole series of efforts to come up with a kind of compromise situation in which risk is being contained. I mention that because it's important to recognize that the basic questions being discussed in the federal context have not been focused primarily upon ethics. They have been focused more on where prudence lies. In the encouragement of research and the handling of the risk which it entails. The other focus which has been controversial, and this has been surprisingly little known, some of you may well be following all of these discussions day by day on listservs, but I suspect most of you have not, is in the emergence of a somewhat curious phenomenon in the National Science Foundation itself, which led to the publication of a series of books coming out of conferences, which were held on specifically the theme of converging technologies. Now, this was a separate process. The NSF has funded and initiated a series of conferences on nanotechnology proper, on the societal implications of nanotechnology, but separately, a series on converging technologies. Just as to help me understand my audience here, how many of you know what that is really all about and what that discussion is and are following along day by day to see, okay, this seems to me to be an area where I can say what I like and you can't say I'm wrong? Well, the National Science Foundation initiated a first conference on converging technologies under the title Converging Technologies to Improve Human Performance. Nano, bio, info, cogno, NBIC, which is a kind of mantra in this discussion. And that conference, which was held, I think, in 2002 from memory, produced a published report a year later called Conversion Technologies for Improving Human Performance, Nano, Bio, Info, Cogno. And it is referred to variously as the NBIC document or the NBIC report. It's a considerable currency in a kind of secondary, largely informal literature, which has emerged around it. And it has been followed by, I think, two or perhaps three other volumes in that series, one called Progress in Convergence, one called Convergence and for Human Well-being, which I think was the most recent one, which I had an essay in. But these have been initiated by the National Science Foundation. Now, what is interesting about these volumes, and the first volume especially, is the tone of the material. Has any of you read that first volume? Well, you can go download it, you know. In fact, you can read it now. Presumably, you're all wired anyway. Take your mind off the lecture. It really is a fascinating document. It was published jointly by the National Science Foundation and the Department of Commerce. It was published, like federal documents tend to be, with appropriate disclaimers, saying that this is just a document produced by the people whose names are on it, but the Department of Commerce and the NSF thinks it's a good idea to get it out. And it was, at one level, simply an academic conference, a somewhat peculiar academic conference, with a published book as a result. However, that was not how it was viewed by various publics, and I'll instance two publics, but I'll tell you first of all why it was a somewhat strange document. It was a strange document because it's been widely seen as essentially a manifesto for a transhumanist read on the significance of converging technologies. Now, transhumanism, as I'm sure most of you do know, is an energetic, philosophical, somewhat sci-fi network of people and ideas, some of them extremely smart, who believe that through these technologies, and remarkably soon, many of them would say, we shall be able to transcend the human condition. Specifically to transcend the human condition so that we no longer have to die, which would certainly appeal to many people as something of an advantage, certainly before they begin to think about what it entails for things like, you know, demography and the environment and some other things. But then, indeed, to go beyond this and to say it isn't just that we can put off the dying of humans, we can then end up being lifted up into persons who live on hard drives and become silicon life forms, and who knows? And some of you smile, and some of you know what I'm talking about, and some of you roll your eyeballs. There are some very serious, smart people having these conversations. And that is a good thing. I'm all in favor of freedom of speech and ideas, and some of these are very charming and delightful people to converse with. What is interesting is that this view essentially dominated that particular book, dominated the conference. And whereas the term improving human performance is a term which you can use to mean pretty much what you like, we all like to have our performance improved, would we not? You work harder at your research project so you can improve your performance. This is an anodyne term. But the meaning given to it in the context of that conference and that book was a thoroughly transhumanist reading. And the book is interesting partly because it begins with an executive summary. Now, it is not conventional in books of conference papers to begin them with executive summaries. You might begin with some sort of overview or introduction or preface. But of course, the assumption is that the papers are going to be all over the place. And therefore, that whereas if you have a policy document, it's appropriate to begin with an executive summary because you have here a clear position and you want to summarize it for the many people who aren't going to read the whole thing. So there are some features internal to this book which are interesting, but what essentially happened when the book was published was that the transhumanists were cock-a-hoop. I mean, these people could not believe their luck. And if you read their listservs, you know, basically they said the U.S. government basically is here taking a transhumanist turn. The other group who responded to it with a similar reading was the European Commission. This may seem a little more strange. And the European Commission and its advisors were so concerned about this document, which they saw essentially as a United States government policy document, that they set up their own commission, a high-level expert group. If you're into Eurospeak, that's a European term for a very high-level commission of inquiry. A high-level expert group, which then produced a series of interim reports and a final report, essentially as a response to this document from the National Science Foundation. And these documents make interesting reading. I wrote an essay about it. I have this book, Nanoscale, which was referred to earlier, which I edited with a colleague, and I have a chapter here which I talk about that controversy and sketch what happened, so you can get all the references. Point being, they interpreted this document as a transhumanist document and as a document coming from the USG. Now, of course, it is not exactly news that Europeans are often somewhat disenchanted with America. They've been perfectly disenchanted in recent years. This is a tradition. Europeans tend to think the worst of Americans, and then they find reasons to think they're right. It is something of a mystery to me that nobody kind of picked up a phone. Although part of the problem of these things is whom do you call? You know, that when documents come out from people in scientific civil service and they put a conference together, I mean, it isn't entirely clear that there's somebody you call and say, what does this mean? But that obviously didn't happen because the high-level expert group produced its seven reports, which are out there eternally on the internet, like the original document is. And it was, they were capped somewhat tactfully, I mean, diplomatically. I mean, they said, because they couldn't say, you know, we're here producing this high-level report to answer this report from the National Science Foundation and tell you why it's wrong, why we don't like it. They have some sort of diplomatic language where they say that this, you know, that we aren't responding to it, but that this was the occasion for our conversation. And so it's a very direct connection. I'm not, you know, I'm not misidentifying the relationship of these documents. And then they produced something which really was, I think, a critique of the NSF document and think sort of set out a basis for a rather different European approach to policy, to what was seen to be the US policy. The most significant component in the European document, perhaps, was their particular concern about cognitive science, which had been brought into this fourfold converging technologies model by the NSF people. In that they said, basically, this is a separate question. They said, we have no real difficulty with talking about convergent technologies. They didn't want to use the branded converging technologies language involving nano, bio, and info, because, of course, at one level, this is a statement of the obvious. These are converging, they're interrelating. To some degree, it's a matter of what you want to call them. But they said the question of cognitive science is very distinctive, and they said they were very concerned about the notion of re-engineering the human brain. And they come up with one locution stating that there should be engineering for the mind, but not of the mind. That is to say, you could do all sorts of things that essentially get to the mind through the five senses, but you should not be looking to take an engineering approach to sort of reverse engineering the brain, which is part of the transhumanist project. So I share that with you as like the other discussion going on in and around federal policy on the National Nano Initiative, with, of course, profound ethical implications. The environmental one has been much more public. This one has been, I think, perhaps in the long term, more consequent. And the real value of it is that you actually now do have these two documents, and we have we have something to talk about. One of the editors, the US document, is co-edited by Mike Rocco. Rocco is a brilliant man who has been the driving force behind the National Nano Initiative. He's a Romanian. He is an energetic engineer, and he's a visionary. And I think his colleagues all deeply admire him, and I admire him personally, and I'm privileged to know him a little personally. His colleague who co-edited this document, and this is a matter of record because his name is on it, is William Sims Bainbridge. And Bainbridge is a card-carrying transhumanist who speaks at conferences. And Bainbridge is also a brilliant man, writes in different fields, and I think he's edited this two-volume encyclopedia of cybernetics. These are very smart people. Bainbridge, plainly, his cards are on the table. And his role in this process, plainly, has been significant. Now, I lay that out because it doesn't seem to me nanotechnology is all about transhumanism at all, any more than nanotechnology is all about the environmentalism. But we have had these two federally centered controversies going on during the last few years, with pretty limited public awareness of them. There's been some awareness of the environmental discussion. There has been almost no awareness, if you like, of this ideological discussion about how we frame the significance of technologies and whether the transhumanist agenda is a good agenda. And, you know, one can take many views, and I'm not entirely sure where humanism ends and transhumanism begins. One of my arguments with transhumanists is that I think they're claiming too much for their vision. I mean, I'm all for all sorts of things we can do technologically to make us better able to be human. Once you start talking about getting rid of human nature and restating the human person as something that is no longer human, I think you're claiming quite unnecessarily grandiose goals and an unnecessarily destructive definition of what is the human. And I think whereas there's no obvious way you draw a line between what is human and what is not human, it does seem to me that's the conversation to be had, and that the human, in fact, contains an awful lot that we have yet to begin to explore before you essentially begin to go to a sort of digital reduction of human nature. And, of course, there are big debates in the artificial intelligence community, not least, about whether digital intelligence ultimately will be able to reproduce something which is comparable to human intelligence. And there are people like Kurzweil who say, of course it will, you just sort of draw the graph, it has to be. And you have others who are deeply involved and expert in the field who would say, we just don't accept that, that there's something different about this kind of intelligence. And that is a different kind of discussion. But what has happened here is there has been a framing of the issue, which I think is very helpful. At the same time, we have, and this is one of the points I want to leave you with tonight, we also have an interesting correlation between, if you like, an internal discussion about whether a transhuman framing of this discussion is appropriate and whether the applications of these technologies should be seen as intended. There's a sort of telos here, which is, in fact, to change human nature. How that discussion relates to the discussion within the business community, the finance community, people in venture capital, in reinsurance, in risk, which essentially sets the frame of reference for the development of these technologies as commercial products. My understanding is that, in fact, this building and this part of the campus is dedicated, not least, to that interrelationship. And one of the things that I find increasingly interesting in my own professional life, because I engage more and more with people in the corporate community on these questions, is that they are the first people to say, we've got to be very careful how we use language to frame the significance of these technologies. Because basically, if you see these as tomorrow's technology with this sci-fi, you know, twist, which the transhumanists do, you raise the risk profile of the technologies in investment terms very significantly. And that what you need to do is to show people that these technologies will enable them to do and to be the things they already want to do and be, in fresh and innovative and effective ways. And so, whereas, of course, people in the corporate and finance world tend to be very cautious of saying anything in public, in private, they are very reluctant and concerned to see this transhumanist branding of nanotechnology. And they've learned not least one from one particular experience, which is another of the stories of the last few years. Some of you may have picked up on. How many of you know about the Magic Nano story? Magic Nano? Well, this is interesting. We seem to have unanimity on all of these points so far. This is the right meeting. This is nanotechnology, yes. Magic Nano, this is going back 2 or 3 years, was a story from Germany about a bathroom cleansing agent which sent 100 people to the hospital with serious respiratory problems. None of them died, but they were serious. These were not trivial difficulties. And Magic Nano sent a shiver down the spine of the nano community worldwide. If someone had died, it would have been a chill in addition to a shiver. And there was speculation, investigation, excitement, rumors about what Magic Nano was. It emerged, and I think this is reliable information, although I don't know if I've seen it documented, that in fact the product was no more nano than it was magic. This was just a bit of branding. And that in fact, although many products, of course, contain things that you can call nano if you want to, that the problem here was being caused by the solvent, which was any old solvent, and not by anything that could be attributed to anything that could be called nano. This illustrated all sorts of things for those interested in the interface of research, policy, risk, and business. One of which was that nano, of course, is not really a technology, it's a brand. Of course, in the title here, we have nanotechnologies, and some people have been careful to use the plural here. Most people don't use the plural. As you know, I mean, the standards organizations and the NSF and so on are all coming up with definitions of nano. And there are several definitions out there. Depends how many dimensions you need and whether there has to be novelty and all sorts of things. And if you look at, of course, the NSF grant protocols, as some of you have, they're very careful. You know, they talk about active nanosystems and so on and so forth to narrow down what they're talking about. But what has happened is that the term nano, and I think this is very much the disadvantage of those interested in investment and development of these products, has emerged essentially uncontrolled as an informal brand for a whole series of areas of research and a whole series of kinds of products, which really have no relationship with each other at all, except that from one perspective or other of scale. And what is more, that because there has been a certain excitement attached to the label, you will get Magic Nano stuck on a product that seems not to be nano any more than it's magic. Though I actually had a law student do a paper for me a year or so ago, a very interesting paper about the trends in nano trademarking in the US, and this will probably be published at some point, I think it has been yet, showing that in fact there has been a trend to debrand with the term nano. It was trending up and it's trended down now. People are taking things that they were calling nano before and calling them something else, the names of companies, names of products. Because the risk of this uncontrolled informal brand snaking across the world and across all of these research areas and products was considered too great. And things like the Magic Nano story, of course, have helped to drive this pulling back. But it is important to recognize that whereas what you may or may not be doing could well be called nanotechnology, that if you seek a definition of the word which embraces everything which could be called nanotechnology, you find something which essentially is too broad to be of any use, but is quite distinctive enough to be very dangerous in commercial terms. And this is one reason, of course, why the corporate community, like the environmentalists, have been coming together to say we need much more publicly funded work on toxicology issues. Because if you find some kind of toxic application by accident, you know, if someone does die, And there's no antecedent reason why that could not happen through a particular conjunction of circumstances and materials and an individual and their health condition and so on and so forth. Then immediately you obviously have a crisis across everything with a label attached. Everything from your Gap, pants, which the wine won't stain, right across to the sort of stuff some of you are doing in the lab. And so there has been a risk element. And interestingly, I was at a meeting on Lake Como a couple of years ago, a US-European meeting called Perspectives on the Future of Science and Technology, which was focused on nano questions. And we were having this conversation around the room, and somebody said, I think somebody from a sort of business analyst said, I think we should have an agreement not to use the word nanotoxicology. Because it just implies, that some sort of innate toxic element there in nano, and it raises a risk. So I said, since I'm something of an iconoclast, I said, okay, now if one of us goes and calls the press tonight, this wasn't a private meeting, it wasn't a sort of confidential discussion, and tells them what you just said, that there are people there who want to stop using the word nanotoxicology, I said, you've already raised the risk. Because, of course, commercial risk is very largely about perception. And if people out there think that you don't dare use the word nanotoxicology, you're suppressing this word, up goes the risk. So I want to emphasize the significance of the risk discussion, which really is driving certainly the enviro end of the policy discussion, and to a significant degree also the sort of transhuman enhancement end of the discussion, a concern ultimately about risk and investment. And there has been something of a problem in getting investment in nano, certainly in small nano companies. Some of you will know this. Nano Business Alliance is pushing for tax breaks and all sorts of things to enable these companies to survive till they get products. And therefore, these risk questions are really very significant. I mean, talking to a venture capitalist a few months ago about some of this stuff, and he said, my friends and I are just not looking for nano companies at the moment. He said, the products are a long way away, and everyone keeps talking about risk. And he said, that's why I'm putting my money somewhere else. So you put these pieces together, and I hope you can see what I'm doing in this presentation. I'm sort of taking sort of core samples here, these related but distinct conversations, to suggest that we need to have a much more effective way of engaging the policy framework around emerging technologies, and this technology in particular, as if you like, the sort of leading edge brand in emerging technologies, so that some of these questions can be better, more properly, more thoroughly, more coherently addressed, and in a way, of course, which enables us to contain the perceived risk as well as the actual risk if products are going to come to market. I'm not naive in thinking that you can always get win-win between those who want to raise scares and those who want to make money. But I think there's often more common ground than would normally be suggested, as of course is evident in, I mentioned the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal from DuPont and Environmental Defense as an example of how common ground can be found in the risk question. Now, I'll say one more thing, and then I'll talk about some of the particular ethical issues that I see facing us down the road. And that is that there has been a problem in deciding where to have this conversation. I think this is one of the difficulties that we've had in the federal government in the last few years. I don't think it's a comment on this administration. I think it's a comment on the way the federal government tends to operate and the way it tends to generate initiatives, which, very difficult to lead and focus because they cut across many agencies. You have many different players involved. You have, obviously, the whole appropriations process. You have OSTP. And, of course, you have the commercial sector, which is intended to be picking up a lot of this stuff and running with it. And at the same time, of course, you've had a bioethics commission, which has recently looked at some nano issues. I don't think they have reported yet, but they have been had some hearings on nano questions. But they have also been operating essentially over here. I mean, there have been many, many participants in these discussions, but there has not been a common conversation. And I mean, I in terms of my own participation, I have been in a number of these conversations myself, and I know that these people tend not to meet each other, and certainly they tend not to sit down and have roundtable conversations. One of the purposes of the conferences, which we have run in Washington, has precisely been to bring some of these players together. And it's always interests me when I introduce people to each other, you know, who haven't met. And if you know, if you work in a field for long enough, you know, you realize the significance of those introductions and the fact that they have not previously been made. And so it seems to me we have to find interdisciplinary and interagency and general sort of multi-approaches to developing a fresh kind of conversation in which risk is one of the central questions, in which policy, if you like, is a deliverable, and which, of course, ethics drives the conversation. Not because, you know, ethics is some magical quality, or because there are sort of some people who are ethical, other people who are not. Because in a democracy, I mean, ethics is our technical term for the values which people bring to the democratic process and the framing, ultimately, of policy. And ultimately, the framing of policy, if it is sound policy, which reflects those values and which contains risk. One of the difficulties of engaging with these different parties or having them engage with each other, of course, is their different timelines. And if you're a researcher, you know, typically it's your next grant, which is perfectly reasonable. I'm not being reductionistic here. I'm just talking about how the world we are all engaged in works. Obviously, if you're a company, it's, you know, next quarter's results, or if basically you don't have results yet because, you know, you're just living off capital while you develop some products. I mean, you're looking, you know, maybe 10 years ahead or whatever you're hoping to break the surface. If you look what's happened to the biotech industry, it's extraordinary the length of time it's been to get products and profits out of a huge sector of the economy. Then you talk to people, of course, in risk management. I had lunch a while ago with a senior person in one of the major insurance companies, who said that her sort of her mandate, this was in Washington, interestingly, her mandate was to think 50 years ahead. And that's the way the reinsurance market works. And depending on the day, they'll talk about 200 years back and forward in terms of the way that they frame the way in which they make money out of risk. So I just quipped back to her, well, who is there in this town who you ever have a conversation with? Because, of course, in Washington, the timeline is typically 2 years, max. During the administration, it might be 3. If you're running for Congress, it's probably, you know, 1.5. And one of the ironies of these emerging technologies is that whereas at one level, sort of things are moving faster and faster and faster, the whole thing's compounding, we know that. At another level, we therefore need to take longer and longer term policy decisions to contain this very rapidly developing field. And what we find is, and I think this is a very helpful perception, it's not my own, I'm borrowing it from others, but we find essentially an increasing divergence between the political timescale and decision making, which is shorter and shorter, certainly shorter than it was before the end of the Cold War when you had more ideological politics. And certainly shorter than it was in Europe before then, when politics, Europe has always been more ideological. You know, and you would think if you had your model and that's what you were fighting for, they're much, much more pragmatic now. Political decision-making gets shorter term. And it's partly because of 24-hour media and a lot of other things, and blogs and so on, you know. Conversely, the need for policy to be set in these fundamental technology areas is longer and longer term. And it's in this crisis, I think, is emerging. The conflux of these two different sets of timescales, which I think is going to be increasingly problematic for us. I'm going to make some comments now about some of the particular questions raised by nano and ethics. I am no fan of the term nanoethics. There's one reason why I'm happy the title says medical ethics, because ultimately the application of much of this will be through the medical healthcare area if it's going to be to individuals. Although, of course, there are also wider issues raised. I think the term nanoethics is, well, and I know the term nanoethics for those who follow the bioethics discussions, I don't like the term bioethics. Therefore, I don't like nanoethics even more because it seems to assume bioethics solved problems for us. I think bioethics has been a way of avoiding addressing problems. And therefore, I think nanoethics is a kind of cheap imitation of this failed product. If that profoundly offends you, then so be it. I have the microphone at the moment. You can tell me. What I'd like to do is to lay out what seem to me to be six areas where it seems to me that there are very specific ethical questions, and these are not profound. I mean, they're basic, but they're not exactly novel, but they are raised in a rather particular way by the discussion of nanotechnology. And the first, of course, lies in the question of hype, expectation, public funding. It is known that one reason why the term nanotechnology came to be pushed back in the late 90s was specifically to encourage congressional funding for engineering. People sat around and said, how can we get more funding for engineering? And they said, let's call it nanotechnology. Now, I'm not making this up. I know people who were in those conversations. I have no objection to people doing this. This is politics. This is how we get money for our projects. You brand things in ways you think will interest those who can fund them. But this has led to the problem of hype, which I think ultimately I'm concerned. I mean, some of you will know the significance of Vannevar Bush, not relation of the President Bush's present President Bush. Vannevar Bush, who was the great visionary of public science at the end of the Second World War. Remarkable man, who really laid the foundations of our public science vision, the notion that you give all this money to the scientists, they divvy it up, peer review, and guess what? They deliver the goods. And this has been the case now for half a century. And that is fraying. It's fraying in a number of ways. And I think there are major concerns about the fraying, even though I think there are some good reasons why it's fraying. But that whole model is under pressure. And one of the pressures being put upon it is the pressure of public expectation. You see this in stem cells, and you see it here in nano, where gross claims are being made that can never be justified. And whereas there are nods and winks among the cognoscenti when they make these statements, the public go home and really believe it's going to happen. Of course, here the classic example, it may still be there, is the nano cancer claim, which certainly was on the website of the NCI. Anyone checked it recently? By 2015, cancer will basically be a chronic condition. There will be no death or serious pain from cancer. 2015, according to Andy von Eschenbach, who was then director of the NCI. It was still there when I checked a few months ago. It's, you know, they will then defend and say, well, this is a goal, it's aspirational. Let me quote to you, interestingly, from Sir Paul Nurse, president of Rockefeller University, Nobel laureate, who in a New Yorker magazine piece a couple of years ago, this was a piece attacking the Bush administration on science policy, which of course is a sort of genre, you know, which we find all over. And I thought it was just unfair he was attacked for this, because it had nothing to do with the administration. It was just people lower down, NCI, who were getting enthusiastic about nano and cancer. But anyway, Paul Nurse has this piece, but he says this. The wording on the website then was, and I think may still be, of the U.S. National Cancer Institute, that thanks to advanced developments in nanomedicine, we shall eliminate suffering and death due to cancer by 2015, quote unquote. That is the goal. Nurse comments, those statements cannot be justified even as a statement of aspiration, because when we fail to deliver, as we surely will, we will lose the confidence of both the politicians and the public. That is a very important statement. And I think that recognition, as well as the absurdity of the claim, will be one of the explanations when the Vannevar Bush system finally collapses, as it may, in the next 10 or 15 years, under all sorts of pressures, and comes into something else. And there are some, well, we haven't got time tonight to discuss this in more detail, but I think there are some basic problems in the whole peer review approach and the way in which public science has operated when it gets into transformative interdisciplinary things. In fact, the National Science Foundation, some of you may know this if you've applied for NSF grants, they got Booz Allen, the management consultants, to do a project last year, I think it was, basically reviewing the peer review system in relation to the problematics of multidisciplinary transformational research. Because the system just tends to prevent that kind of thing happening, even if the rhetoric is all about the importance of doing that. That's one small thing part of a big picture. Public confidence, politicians expecting, demanding. If you think this claim was simply merely aspirational, if you like aspirational with, you know, uppercase A, if you go Google a Senate hearing shortly after the statement was put on the website, a senator asked the NCI director, I think it was Eschen back then, how much more would it take to do this by 2010? Now, I would have thought, hoped everybody would start laughing, you know, somebody would, you know, blow a raspberry. I mean, you know, this is farce. But no, it's a Senate hearing. And the NCI came back and said about $5 billion. Now, plainly they have here access to a crystal ball unavailable to the rest of us. And anybody who remembers the war on cancer, with its very marginal effect on morbidity or mortality over a generation now, great idea, but knows the problem of making these claims. The notion is you pump enough money in, all the graphs have to go up, and we're bound to cure the problem. It is not how it happens in science. Now, you know that. Most of you people are scientists. Do you know exactly? It's not how it happens in science. And if you talk about it as if it happened that way with politicians, not least with appropriators who fund your projects, you'll find a law of diminishing returns. So this is a fundamental ethical question in which really there is win-win because you let the rhetoric loose, the hype loose, and ultimately you will lose credibility. Briefly, the others. The whole question of risk. This is a fundamental ethical issue, if you like, because dying is not good, but it's certainly an ethical question when you begin to balance risks and decide who should take the risks. What do we expose workers to? I know a professor with a federal funding for a nano-related project told me this 2 or 3 years ago. He said he closed down the project, sent the money back. He said he was just so concerned about all the particles he was generating. He had all these young researchers working with him who had families. And one night he just said, I couldn't live in myself. We closed it down. Now, this guy isn't some sort of activist. He is a researcher. I told that story in Washington to some people who should have been able to do something about it and who were certainly horrified. But, you know, nothing happened. That's not a story to get into the press. You know, what would the Sun Times or the, you know, the New York Post make of that? Third ethical question, of course, for the clinically related questions, which is like sort of the more medic, obviously traditionally medical questions. And some of you will know, before the Human Genome Project got into its stride, there was a lot of concern about the implications, of course, particularly of recombinant DNA therapies, which, because they've been so slow to be developed, have been much less of a problem than we thought they would be. But there was a major concern to develop a code of conduct to make sure people were content, they were happy, that there was a sense of confidence in the research going on, and that we would look at its implications for ELSI, the term used for ethical, legal, and social issues. And that needs to be updated and focused on whatever the particular implications are of this technology. I mean, who knows, this nano-cancer stuff, some obviously there's some extraordinary stuff going on. I'm not in any way demeaning it, you know, in terms of nano-shelves and some of these other things. I heard Naomi Hallis from Rice talking about her work on nano-shelves recently, and it's quite extraordinary what's happening now in areas of cancer research. But what are the ethical implications of this, if it is, you know, A, extraordinarily expensive, you know, or B, or C, or D? I mean, there are all sorts of ethical dimensions here, quite apart from, of course, from the risk issues involved in new treatments and clinical trials. And, you know, do we let the FDA take 10 years to enable these things to happen? I mean, how do we handle the very rapid development of these technologies when they begin to produce clinical impacts? Fourthly, broader questions. Perhaps the most obvious one that has been discussed is the question of RFID. You know, radio frequency identifiers, these little tags, which are very cheap. They haven't become as cheap as people thought they would by now, I am told, but that they are still very cheap, being used for inventory by some stores that ultimately could forever track everything. I mean, what are the privacy implications? Interesting, a couple of years or so ago, a company did a promotional campaign for a car. Some of you may have seen this. In which people who bought these new cars over a certain period had an RFID on their key fobs. And when they drove past certain advertisements, the advertisement would reconfigure to speak to them directly. And you know, if you in the film Minority Report, is it Minority Report, where he walks down the mall and his irises are red or something, and the ads talk to him directly. Oh, happy birthday, you know, and so on. Well, this basically has been doing that. This was experimental, but it was an ad company. These weren't ethics people, these weren't science people. Using the technology in an experimental way. So that, you know, happy birthday, Nigel. You know, this from the hoarding, if you drive down the road. But you begin to reflect on the privacy implications of that kind of tracking, that kind of information. Where does it all go? Who are these computers that store all this stuff? And of course, the RFID industry is very concerned about these things and concerned to develop the technology. There's been a push for the idea that RFID should be required by law to be destroyed at point of sale if you want to use it for inventory. So you get your bag of sugar and, you know, Walmart tracks your bag of sugar until you get it, and then it's your bag of sugar, and you can take it where you like, and they won't know. But again, this is in some ways a rather traditional technology. This has been around for a few years now. But with the concerns about security, the pressure, you know, ultimately to have everything safe, privacy is going to be perhaps the most expensive commodity of the 21st century. Vast ethical questions. And then six, the question of the fundamental issue of the integrity of the human condition and the implication of technologies which can shift the human condition into something which it has not previously been capable of. There's been this controversy recently about the sprinter with the artificial legs who's been banned from the Olympics because apparently it takes 25% less energy to run as it would with normal legs. So he actually isn't disabled, he is enabled, he's enhanced abled. Case in point, in sense, this is America, it's in sports that many of these issues will be resolved, of course, all the way from all the steroid stuff and growth hormone, all the way to these prosthetics. But it is, of course, being speculated that it will not be long before you can buy a chip to put in your teen's brain so that he or she will be able to ace school. Certainly the computational parts of school and perhaps the creative parts of school. And if you can do this, if you can buy it, is this a proper thing to do for the human community? Well, in fact, the compounding of those sort of enhancements end up undermining not simply our notions of equity and greatly, you know, distance. I mean, as it is, we have this bimodal income distribution. I think it's the worst. Brazil, I think, has the biggest bimodal distribution in the world. But I mean, vast increases in the wealth of those who have these capacities, because of course, computational skills, which are the ones most easily, you know, replicable in digital terms, are the skills that make you money. Because, you know, you can deal with the markets and so on and so forth. Is this the way we want to go? And this is the sort of thing that has, of course, the most dramatic ethical implications. Whether your concern is, if you like, kind of conservative concern about, you know, integrity, bodily integrity, human nature, or whether your concern is about distributive justice, which is more a sort of liberal kind of concern. I think these terms are pretty unhelpful, particularly as technologies tend to press us into raising new kinds of questions, which the old spectrum of left and right doesn't fit. And then if, like, finally, I mean, this is a seventh, but it's a different kind of question, you have the military applications. Obviously, we're presently using all sorts of clever things in warfare. Most people don't think warfare is always wrong. You may disagree with a particular war. This is a different kind of question. But what does it mean if you could fight a war using basically robotic platforms and guarantee no American casualties? I mean, this might, of course, mean that you'd use your military in quite different ways. It's one thing to reduce your casualties and contain them. Another thing to be absolutely certain you won't have any. Because everyone's basically working in bunkers and bases here in the US, and you have machines doing all the fighting for you. I mean, these are profound ethical questions. I was very struck during an analog of this, of course, was the US involvement back in the 90s in the wars in Bosnia, when what we did, and it had good effects, of course, the Kosovo situation has recently been back on the front pages, was to engage in very high-level bombing, which is far more accurate than it used to be, but of course, there was a lot of collateral damage. And this was a calculation taken by the then administration that if there were American casualties, the whole thing would collapse. The only way to do this is to take those risks and accept a certain amount of civilian casualties as a result. And there are a lot of ethical issues involved in that discussion. My point is, it will be that on a massive scale if you moved over to using fundamentally mechanized and robotic military platforms. There was a comment made at the time by a French officer, and France took a lot of casualties in the Balkans, as you may know, took hundreds of casualties through their presence there on the ground. And he said, if a cause is worth killing for, it has to be worth dying for. Now, what happens if you remove the killing from the possibility of dying? I mean, that's a different kind of question, but it's a question with vast ethical as well as policy implications. So let me sum up now. We've been a little longer than I had intended to be. It seems to me that the example provided by the development of nanotechnology, these environmental debates, the discussions about transhumanism, the lack of a public policy context for these discussions, so you can have this rather strange transhumanist enterprise at the National Science Foundation and the European response and so on. The problems of the business community in dealing with technologies which are inherently risky in perceptual terms, whatever their actual risk may be. The problems of branding technology, which brands itself and snakes right across all sorts of products and areas of research without your being able to control the fact that people will perceive this as the same thing, even though it is a number of very different things. These questions suggest the need for a much more informed, engaged, common public conversation about what ultimately are ethical questions that underlie policy and frame the way in which we engage in the development and of these technologies and ultimately in the products that they will lead to and the way in which we hope they will enhance our capacity to be human, whether or not we think they should develop capacities within us so we can enhance our notion of what persons can be, for they can be more than human. The policy discussions are as important as they can get. Thank you very much. Well, I suppose, I mean, I'm not sure whether we have resolved other issues within the traditional ethical theories. We've at least found ways of stating the questions. My suspicion is that we're going to find we need wholly fresh ways to frame the conversation. What transhumanists tend to do is to see this simply, if you like, in libertarian terms. It's a matter of these are freedom issues. They have this wonderful phrase, morphological freedom, which is not the freedom to be thin or fat, which would seem to be a reasonable freedom, which at some point, surely, you know, there'll be a pill for. But which is the freedom if you choose to have wings or, you know, to live on a hard drive or, you know, a sort of ontological, morphological freedom. And I think that these are questions which it is very hard to find a location for within our conventional ethical discussions, which is one reason why there tends to be very little discussion of them, because they sort of skate, you know, right across the surface of traditional ethical engagement. And they simply say, well, this is about freedom, you know, and sort of end of conversation, therefore we can do it. And then if you press them, then of course, then you get into a utilitarian type of discussion, as most ethical discussions tend to, whether they're utilitarian in conviction or not, setting up the questions. And then it all depends what kind of weighting you give to things. I mean, you know, radical life extensionism is an example. I've been having some exchanges recently with Aubrey de Grey, you know, who is the great proponent of radical life extension, a very sharp guy. And he, and I don't know whether he is a transhumanist. He hangs out with a transhumanist, and I've been trying to press him on this a little. Because, of course, there's nothing transhuman in itself about people living longer. Because transhumanism is about adding new capacities. And this is not a new capacity. It's just you put off dying by another 100 years or 300 years or something. But how do you how do you weight those years? I mean, he will argue, well, those years are life years, and whether you have disability-adjusted life years, quality of life. There are various categories health economists use to discuss whether we should put money into pediatrics, you know, or into geriatrics, because you can there's an outcome in terms of years. And he says you can just do this, because isn't it incredible? If you can go from, you know, from 85, 90, you know, with 115 being the final cutoff or something, you know, to 520. He said, it's a no-brainer. You just push the NIH budget over there. And so, I mean, there are fresh kinds of questions being raised here. And, of course, I think, you know, a year isn't a year isn't a year. I think, you know, for a child to be able to live through childbearing age, reproductive age, and, you know, die even in his or her 40s or 50s or something, I mean, that 50 years to be gained by what we do in, you know, childhood diseases in Africa or something, is of a different kind to the years that you get on the end if you're already 80. But I mean, I think there's a problem in framing the questions. Because I mean, that's a good example, because he's working on the basis of, you know, collies and dollies and so on, and these notions, and he's simply extending it. Whether that means you've got to have fundamental new ethical theories, I don't know. I think it certainly means you've got to have a sort of fresh paradigm within which you use your ethical theories to solve the problems.
I've also looked briefly at some of the transhumanist literature. It seems that you've been at the surface of these people. The goals that they have, the claims that they make. I guess my two questions. First is quick to answer. How strong are the numbers? One thing I insist in a little bit of the progress of the human condition or the transhuman condition rather. And I'm wondering what this is progress towards, if there's any consensus as to what this progress consists in developing towards, and suppose that they were as a group given unlimited funding, free and wasn't they able to accomplish, what is the end product?
Well, I think it's
how can they possibly expect, you know, to go forward?
I mean, I think they will tend to answer it in terms of you know, providing more freedom for people to be able to make more choices about more aspects of who they are. I mean, that's the
what they are.
Well, that's your question. I don't want to be unfair to them. I think they have this notion that basically we're all sitting here in our cocoons, and there are butterflies out there. And if only we would sort of shape up, we could fund the process to get rid of these cocoons. And, you know, and it's perfectly fair in that situation not to have answers to that question. I think, to go to your first point, I mean, there are not very many of them. I mean, I suppose there are probably 3,000 or 4,000 people in their basic networks. Kurzweil, sort of Ray Kurzweil, many of you will know, is a brilliant genius inventor, among other things, who his notion of the singularity, which is the point at which basically artificial intelligence takes over, which tends to sort of recede a certain amount. But in fact, there was a congressional report. I mean, the Joint Economic Committee of Congress. I mean, you know, believe this if you have a strong stomach to believe things that I'm just saying to you, you know, unwarranted you may think. The Joint Economic Committee of Congress produced its first, I think, report on nanotechnology about a couple of years ago. Spring, I think, 2 years ago. Maybe it was last spring. And basically bought Kurzweil. And it said, there's periodization nanotechnology development, and by 2020, we will have the singularity. Now, what interests me is that it wasn't that this produced people's, you know, got people scared or interested or worried or, you know, falling around laughing. It's no one noticed it. It wasn't reported anywhere. Not anywhere. And if you believe that, what are the implications for Iraq? We can't be there for 100 years because guess what? 2020, the machines take over and everything becomes... And you see, the transhumanists tend to have this endless optimism. It's a wonderful thing. I think it's a rather childlike thing. Maybe I don't want to be demeaning to them because I know these guys are very smart and I like them. Some of them are not so smart and I've debated a number of these people. They have this sort of boyish enthusiasm and confidence that everything's going to be okay. I mean, at a conference here ago, Orbiter de Grey was asked by a friend of mine after one of his things about radical life extension, well, who will make sure? Because he was saying everyone will get it. It'll be wonderful. And someone said, well, you know, how will we ensure? Everyone doesn't get clean water. Why should they all get this? Everyone doesn't get healthcare. Right? He said, democracy. Now, there's a certain, a sort of jejeune quality about a statement like that. You have to look at the record. I mean, I think most people are quite well-intentioned. I think most people, in the West, in this country, whatever that... I mean, they're mostly people who would love everyone to get all this stuff. It's just exceedingly complicated delivering it, and people have interests and so on. I think that their goal is not clear. It's that they want to be free to find out. And they tend to accompany that with, an excessive confidence in, human goodness, kindness, and the notion, in a sense, that in the process of developing these sort of rather geekish technologies, to put one label on, the people who tend to enthuse about these things, outside the context of the broader human situation, is that they tend to take the view that technology, as it were, will make everybody nicer. There'll be a kinder, gentler human coming up because of all this stuff that's going to be so, and I think this is extraordinarily naive. I mean, I think because the basis of any policy decision is that people are all nasty and selfish. And I think most people are not nasty and selfish. I really have quite a high view of, I know people who take a million views on these issues, but you get them all together in a society and you get them making decisions. And, it is a total uphill task to get people to deliver goods to the poor and so on. So, I think there's that naivety there that somehow people are surely all going to be nicer because they have more stuff. My experience, people with more stuff are often the people who are least nice. Yes.
Ideas of branding and upon how do we frame this discussion. It seems like perhaps I completely misunderstood where you were going with this, but seems like you're trying to say that where we need to start is we need to get ourselves all on the same page in terms of the language we're using and go from there, and eventually we'll figure it out when we look at these particular questions. My inclination, perhaps this is just because I'm an applied ethicist, but my inclination is let's start with these particular questions, like the ones at the end that you mentioned. Like, for instance, who should take the risk on these things? Let's figure something like that and then go from there. And if people have different views about what nanotechnology means, too bad, let's work that out later, because there is this thing, regardless of whether we call it. And that's the thing that we need to work out the ethical implications of. I don't know, maybe you agree, maybe I just misunderstood you, but where, or maybe you think that, that's secondary if you're talking, you haven't addressed it yet, but where do you think that the starting point is when we address the interface of ethics and nanotechnologies?
Well, yes, I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying. I think that this is an iterative process. We have to have those conversations, but we have to develop the context in which that conversation is going to make sense and going to find some sort of valence and salience and so on. And I think that part of our problem is that we don't have the context for the conversation. Now, I don't know, the President's Council on Bioethics is a good example. Leon Kass, who's a personal friend of mine, I have a lot of admiration for him, and Pellegrino, who's chairing it now. But the President's Council has had remarkably little effect on public policy in this country. Proved very controversial. They produced some very interesting books that their critics mostly haven't read. But they we've had, you know, we had the NBAC, the predecessor Biothics Commission under the Clinton administration, which was somewhat similar in being having a center of gravity to its thinking, if it was somewhat diverse also. But, I mean, the impact on policy has been very, very minimal. And I think one of the problems is we stick ethics labels on bodies like this, and then we just sort of, you know, push them out into the pond, let them float. And what we have to do is to recognize that these are fundamental policy questions. That I mean, the questions of economic policy, questions of tax policy. I mean, I'm going to give you an example, which is a little promo, which maybe I'm finishing with. I don't know. I'm actually developing a new think tank in Washington called the Center for Policy on Emerging Technologies. What is, I think, the most bizarre fact, in a sense, sort of underlies the first half of what I was saying, is that there is remarkably little in the way of a policy community. We have huge expenditures in public-funded science, which, despite the critics of the president, you know, have basically been doubled in the course of this administration, even if they flatlined more recently. We have, you know, vast questions being raised. We have the economy entirely dependent upon the success of what happens to these technologies, increasingly so. And there are probably 20 think tanks in Washington on tax policy. There's a bunch on economic policy. There's a bunch on defense policy. There is not one that is independent and seeks to address the questions being raised by emerging technologies. So, well, there is now. Some of us have started it, and we have, you know, patronage from all over the place. We haven't got a lot of money yet. But my point is that you haven't got you've got to do both. If it's parallel processing, it's also iterative. Yes, we've got to talk about these things. I mean, like the whole question of robotic warfare and its implications for defense policy. I mean, or, you know, like the distributive justice implications of the vast ramping up, you know, what has been called the nano divide in more in European sort of, you know, left of center context. Then by the same token, we have to develop the context in which it makes sense to have the conversation. One reason why I think bioethics has failed is because it never managed to get this conversation out of a sort of specialty internal discussion among theoreticians into mainstream public policy, except on sort of hot button issues, which are going to be there anyway. So I don't want a nanoethics to take over this thing. I think this really has to be a policy discussion informed by the values of the community, as democracy always should be when it functions. And one of the, I mean, part of what we're trying to do with this new project, my sort of case study in this, and I'll maybe come back in 2 years' time to see if it worked, but specifically is to bring together the corporate finance investment sort of communities, insurance, reinsurance, risk, and so on, with the sort of NGO academic ethics people, left, right, center, asking hard questions, and with the mainstream public policy people. I think that's the only way in which you'll be able to have the conversation that will shape the future. I think continuing the present kinds of conversation are not going to get there. The Enviro will always push FDA, EPA, they'll sue them, is very useful. I'm glad they're there. Conservatives will fight over embryo type issues, and I'm a conservative on the embryo, but this is not tomorrow's question. Anything after birth, their interest will slip, will subside. I mean, there are no conservatives out there marching about nanotechnology. The business community will have internal discussions, will want to push risk onto government. And governments basically will want to push it back. And this seems to me to be a sort of formula for dysfunction. So I think, to your question, yes, we have to do both. And there's an iterative process. I'd love, however, to have the context. I mean, the resources are there. There are smart people having these discussions, writing these books. They're all over the place. We've got to have a context in which that discussion begins to mean something for the shaping of policy, and not just policy on, you know, flashpoint, controversial, ad hoc questions, but the basic shaping of policy about the future of the art community, which will be utterly dominated by these technology questions, whether we like it or not. Thank you very much.